thanks for having me. It's always kind of a strange feeling when I get invited back. I kind of go, oh, all right. You do realize I'm a one-hit wonder. I've got a bit of a croak in my throat, so sorry. So if I begin to sound too croaky, just say, Sean, have a drink. I've begun to understand my ministry as one which starts a conversation, not one which finishes a conversation. And so I'm going to throw out a lot of material at you this morning in the hopes that we can have a great conversation. I'm not a chaplain. Sorry. I'm a New Testament scholar, and that's where I spend my time. That's where I spend my days. But I love the interface, the interaction between Christians and the world. And I think you're on the cutting edge of that. And so I'm very interested in what you're doing. And I'm very much one of your champions going, please go, 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 and teach me as much as you can while you're doing it. And so I had a little bit of a crash course in chaplaincy because I figured last time was pure fluke, that I had something useful to say. So this time I'd actually come prepared. And so we'll see if I've actually learned anything. Sometimes I open the newspaper or I turn on the television and I think to myself, this is not the way it's supposed to be. At other times I see my wife and daughter playing together. I see friends helping one another. I see virtue triumphing over vice. And I think to myself, this is the way it's supposed to be. When confronted with beauty, virtue, and goodness, I often wonder to myself, why can't it be like this all the time? Surely we don't need all that other bad stuff. Wouldn't life be utterly fantastic if it was like this all the time? Celebrating friends, enjoying the wonders of God's creation, helping each other. This is the way it's supposed to be. Sharing our lives, being generous to one another, looking after one another, being there for one another, enjoying good food and laughter together. And then it dawned on me that the Old Testament has a similar vision. The Old Testament prophets dreamed of an age in which human crookedness would be straightened out, rough places made plain, the foolish would be made wise, and the wise humble. They dreamed of a time when the deserts would flower, the mountains would run with wine, weeping would cease, and people could go to sleep without weapons on their laps. People would work in peace and work to fruitful effect. Lambs could lie down with lions. All nature would be fruitful, benign, and filled with wonder upon wonder. All humans would be knit together in brotherhood and sisterhood, and all nature and all humans would look to God, walk with God, lean toward God, and delight in God. Shouts of joy and recognition would well up from valleys and seas, from women in streets and from men on ships, the webbing together of God, humans, and all creation in justice, fulfillment, and delight. And all this is what the Hebrew prophets call shalom. In the Bible, shalom means universal flourishing. It's one of my favorite words, flourishing. Wholeness, delight, a rich state of affairs in which natural needs are satisfied and natural gifts fruitfully employed. A state of affairs that inspires joyful wonder as its creator and savior opens doors and welcomes creatures in whom he delights. Shalom, in other words, is the way things are supposed to be. When you look at a situation, an experience, an event, and you think to yourself, that's the way it's supposed to be, then the Bible says, that's shalom. The Christian scriptures advocate that the goal of life is not merely to exist, but to flourish as human beings. And the way to flourish, the way to enjoy life the way it's supposed to be, is to create, maintain, and enjoy relationships. That is the purpose of human life. Christians believe that God created us for this purpose. Christians believe that Jesus modeled this purpose for us, and that he is an example of a life that worked tirelessly to make things the way they are supposed to be. To model life the way things are supposed to be. To create communities of people who will promote and embody his vision of human flourishing, i.e. shalom. Now, I don't have time to unpack this in a lot of detail, but there are four specific aspects of shalom in the Old Testament. And you can conceive of them as in right relationships. The first thing, to have a life that flourishes, to have this shalom, one needs to be in right relationship with God. Okay? The second thing is you need to be in right relationship with other people. The third thing is you need to be in right relationship with yourself. And then you need to be in right relationship with your surroundings. So those are four aspects of shalom. And when those four aspects of right relationship with God, right relationship with others, right relationship with yourself, and right relationship with your environment, when those relationships are right, the Bible says that's it. That's shalom. That's human flourishing. When these four relationships are right, i.e. they are working and thriving the way they're supposed to be, then that is the state of shalom or human flourishing. That's not what we have today. The goal of contemporary life, according to most people, and of course according to advertising in Hollywood, is to be happy. But what exactly is it to be happy? For the last decade or more, the happiness craze has been building. In 2013, over 1,000 books on happiness were released on Amazon, including Happy Money, Happy People Pills, and for those just starting out, Happiness for Beginners. In fact, recently, science researchers have also noted that happiness is not enough for human beings to flourish. Enter a philosophical debate that has been raging among Western philosophers for more than 2,000 years about the nature of the good life, or what does it mean to flourish. Essentially, the debate boils down to this question: does happiness lie in feeling good, or does happiness lie in doing and being good? That's the question. Does happiness lie in feeling good, or does happiness lie in being and doing good? The technical terms, if you want them, is hedonism, hedone, the Greek word for pleasure, about your own feelings of pleasure or happiness, or another Greek word, eudaimonism. Eudaimonism, which is just a fancy word for human flourishing or flourishing. Is it all about my feelings, or is it about something more? Happiness is associated with selfish taking, often. A sense of meaning in life or flourishing is associated with selfless giving. Being happy is about feeling good. Flourishing is derived from contributing to others or to society in a bigger way. Happiness without meaning characterizes a relatively shallow, self-absorbed, or even selfish life in which things go well, needs and desires are easily satisfied, and difficult or taxing entanglements are avoided. If anything, pure happiness is linked not to helping others in need. Partly what we do as human beings is to take care of others and to contribute to others, so this forms a deep problem. If happiness is all about me, myself, and I, and yet the way to gain flourishing or meaning is to engage with others, that's a problem. A key feature in the tons of literature on happiness which I've actually tried to read, is that happiness is associated with health. If you're happy, you're more likely to be healthier. There seems to be some kind of biological link between happiness and health. But that's just scratching the surface. According to a new study by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, people who are happy but have little to no sense of meaning, i.e. an activity that's associated with benefiting others, have the same gene expression patterns as people who are enduring chronic adversity. I'm gonna unpack this a little bit, so don't worry. Just stay with me. People who are happy but have little to no sense of meaning in their lives have the same gene expression patterns as people who are enduring chronic adversity. Let me unpack that a little more. The studies of the authors of the study argue that people who are happy but have little to no sense of meaning in their lives, simply here for the party, have the same gene expression patterns as people who are responding to and enduring chronic adversity. That is, the bodies of these happy people are preparing them for bacterial threats by activating the pro-inflammatory response. Chronic inflammation is, of course, associated with major illnesses like heart disease and various cancers. Empty positive emotions, like the kind people experience during manic episodes or artificially induced euphoria from alcohol or drugs, are about as good for you as adversity or chronic illness. Stay with me. Now, don't misunderstand the study. Happiness is not intrinsically a bad thing. I like to be happy. In fact, I am most happy when I am in my library all alone. Can you see how selfish that is? Because there's nobody else around. And my books, they don't talk back to me. And if they do, I just put them back on the shelf and I pick another one. Happiness is not a bad thing. It's just incomplete without meaningful activities which connect us to helping people. I want you to be happy. I just don't want you to be self-absorbed, because that's detrimental to your well-being, contrary to popular opinion. Now, some of you think that's really interesting, but I bet others are beginning to wonder, what does this have to do with being a chaplain, Sean? Stay with me. Hopefully it will make sense in the end. And if it doesn't, I'm reading a wonderful book on hate, and we can talk about that. I understand chaplaincy in a broad sense as providing a service that draws on the experience, wisdom, and practices of a specific religious community, in our case Christian, in order to serve institutions or other settings that may or may not have religious affiliations or ethos. The service of chaplaincy relates both to institutions or settings themselves and to the individuals within them. And as far as I can understand from reading copious amounts of literature, it has four dimensions. One is worship and other specific spiritual practices. One is pastoral care. One is advocacy, although that was a debated one in the literature. And the other one is raising questions of meaning, value, and purpose within an institution. And I think my talk today is trying to address this last one, although I think it has interesting consequences for the others. I draw various inferences from this research and this understanding of chaplaincy. First, you as chaplains are doing meaningful work by helping others, and you need to know that that will aid and enrich your own flourishing. Okay? So by you helping others, by you going beyond yourself, by you engaging in the practice of chaplaincy, you are actually doing meaningful activities that will benefit your own sense of well-being. In fact, many people testify to a deep joy that emanates from loving others and a sense of calling to stand with those who are struggling. You need to allow this joy to feed and nourish your own soul. You need to know that Jesus and the Father are deeply moved by your own compassion and service, and you will receive a well done, good and faithful servant. Essentially because you're doing exactly what God does. God goes beyond himself, even at great cost to himself, to benefit others, i.e. the cross. Okay? So that's the first thing. Secondly, chaplains are often taught deliberately how to get a feel for what is bothering a person, how to see through surface matters to deeper issues and problems, and how to stay with the person in sorrow and not try to fix it. Chaplains are, however, not usually taught, and this is where I'm open because I've just been reading the literature. I haven't been hanging out with you. Chaplains are, however, not usually taught how to sense a glimmer of gladness in someone's story or in some community story, much less how to stay with it or help magnify positive experiences of love, community, and even God's grace. At times, it's tempting to perhaps focus solely on crises such as illness, trauma, loss, grief, psychiatric illness, interpersonal violence, disaster relief, so that you become pain specialists. Thus, many times, chaplains are unaccustomed, untrained, and perhaps unable to care helpfully for people who are longing for the fullness of healing, hope, joy, strength, or well-being. If the research on meaning has taught me anything, then we need to learn strategies for helping people connect meaningful activity to their own stories, as this will aid flourishing. As a footnote, I'm encouraged to see this happening already in narrative therapy. Perhaps that's something we can talk about later. I take it as axiomatic that the reason you are a chaplain is that you care about people and want them to flourish. For you to aid human flourishing, we have to know what it is for a human being to flourish and what are the associated misconceptions around human flourishing. That's why I spend all the time talking about meaningful activity and happiness. I'd like to propose that you as chaplains understand yourselves in a certain way. And that is, I want you to embrace a certain identity, and I want to give you a certain strategy for promoting human flourishing. But given that I understand some of the difficulties associated with this, I'd first like to encourage you with a little piece from a book called God Zone, which my lovely friend Amanda is going to read to you.
Okay. To love is to suffer. When you open your heart to another, you risk pain as a diver risks the bends. You give of yourself, and the one you love carries that part which you have given. If they betray your love, you can no more withdraw it than you can cash a cancelled check. You can only endure the pain and go through it. Some people who have their heart torn resolve never to open it again, never to take the risk of leaving the door open to further pain. But the love and pain go together, and few of us can live without love for any length of time. Some travellers have relationships in which they exchange only bodies and minds. But the road wise know that you get what you give, and that holding back on love is as foolish as ignoring your bladder. Better to take the love with the suffering than to miss out on both. The greater the love, the greater the suffering. God, the original lover, is also the original sufferer. All the pain of the universe floods into that great heart. God invented passion, which is both the abandonment of love and the agony of suffering. To know one is to know the other. To have a capacity for love is to have an equal capacity of pain. The doctors of doctrine, the rule makers, the scorekeepers would have us believe that God cannot suffer. Through this cruel canon, they deny the love of God. They create a God in their own image, a thin, loveless, boring parody of a God. Unfortunately, this anemic deity has found its place in much dutiful religion. An even darker thought comes from the moralists and inquisitors that God causes suffering. They paint a picture of a sadistic tyrant God who rules through fear and threat of punishment. Such a demon God, it would be our duty to resist with all our strength. We can do without a sarcastic schoolteacher of the sky. But why should we listen to the nonsense of those who seek to bolster their own inadequacy through flaunting a divine dictator? It will not take long for some grey-faced cynic to ask, why then should God allow suffering to exist in the universe? If God is love, why should anyone suffer? Why doesn't the cosmic plumber fix things once and for all? This is a real question, and it drives right to the heart of faith. However, suffering is not an algebra problem to be solved. It is an agony born. Like a bloody birth, suffering springs from letting be. True love can only exist between free beings. Try buying it or demanding it, it disappears faster than a bouncer's sense of humour. So when the lover sung the universe into existence, freedom was woven into its magic. Freedom to accept or reject the composer of the symphony. Freedom to accept or reject the unique score which belongs to each organism of life. Freedom for harmony, for good or evil. There is no explanation for suffering, only understanding. No solution. Only participation. The love of God is suffering love, a love which has won over its bitterest enemies, a love which has waited all this time for you.
Okay, so let me just recap. I started off talking about the Old Testament's vision of life as human flourishing. I then moved on to contemporary neuroscience research, which suggests that for us to have a meaningful life, we have to engage not only in the pursuit of happiness, which is all about me and my feelings, but we have to engage and participate and practice in meaningful activities. And meaningful activities are associated with benefiting other people in some tangible way. And that, for me, I think, is where you guys come. And that, I think, is where chaplaincy really has a beautiful contribution to make. So, let's talk strategy. In their work, A General Theory of Love, three psychiatrists make the bold claim that who we are and what we become depends in part on whom we love. My mom wisely notes, I listen to her, that who we are and who we become depends also in part on who loves us. A vivid example of this is seen in the documentary The Dark Matter of Love, which is about the psychological aspects of growing up without parental love. Our identity is wrapped up in the constant shaping forces of love. How we are loved, were loved, and will love is shaped by those who love us, have loved us, and will love us. The lack of love in our past, present, or future will have significant effects on who we are, the way we understand our sense of who we are, where we belong, and our purpose in life. The key ingredient of all of this is, of course, relationships. And we're back to neuroscience. Neuroscience tells us that human beings are hardwired for relationships. We crave community. This insight confirms the Christian scriptures, which have been advocating this vision of life for millennia. We were created for community. We see this in the book of Genesis when God is creating and sees Adam alone. What does he do? He declares, "This is not the way it's supposed to be." It's my paraphrase. And God promptly intervenes to create a helper for Adam. Don't think of the term helper negatively, because sometimes I think people use that word and it may sound demeaning. Whereas the Hebrew word hezer is often used of God in his relation to human beings. God is our helper. It's a word which denotes honor and power. God created another to help. And you, as chaplains, are called to be God's helpers. You are called to flourish and to help others to flourish as well. And one of the key ways we flourish as human beings is by being relational. But the problem, Howard Zehe, the father of the restorative justice movement, writes this: "The church should be a place of refuge, but often we have not known how to listen, how to be present to victims. We have told them that their anger is wrong, that they need to move on, to forgive, to forget. We have denied them the right to mourn and instead have laid new burdens on them. All this is understandable as part of our effort to distance ourselves from pain and vulnerability, but it's not that helpful. I think you as chaplains have a unique role. You have a unique place in that you get to walk with people in their pain. You get to walk alongside people who are going through pain. But to actually help them, you have to know who you are. To help them, you need to flourish as a human being. And you need to be able to know how to help them to flourish. So, my doctorate, since that's what I know, focused on the intersection between Christians and outsiders. And it's from 1 Peter. And so I'm just going to sketch a few things from 1 Peter here that I hope will be helpful to you. Because I know the letter quite well, I'm going to move through it quite fast. And so if you have any questions, feel free to stop me or say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, can you just unpack that a little more?" Or I believe we have set aside a large little chunk after this for me to engage specifically with your questions. Okay. So in 1 Peter chapter 1, Peter writes to the exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia, who have been chosen and destined by God the Father and sanctified by the Spirit through the obedience of Jesus Christ, who was sprinkled with his blood. May grace and peace be yours in abundance. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has caused us to be born again into a hope that is alive through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and into an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, unfading, kept in heaven specifically for you, who are being protected by the power of God through faithfulness for a salvation ready to be revealed at the climactic moment. In this you rejoice, even if now for a little while you have had to suffer the pain of various trials, so that the genuineness of your faith, being more precious than gold, which, though perishable, is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed." Peter writes to a group of Christians that are marginalized, they're abused, they're outsiders, they don't belong in contemporary society, and contemporary society likes to point this out. You're weird. You're different. You don't go along with the crowd. You don't do what everybody else does, and that's a problem for us. And so these Christians are being abused, mostly verbally, according to 1 Peter, but often it would result in beatings or physical harm. And so what Peter does is he writes a letter to try and help these Christians as they engage with outsiders, as they engage with those who are not part of the community of Christians. And the first thing he wants you to know is that you are recipients of God's benefaction. God has acted on your behalf. You have a future, you have life, you have the joy of knowing who God is, and according to Peter, you are being protected by the power of his faithfulness. Now that's a beautiful truth. Because sometimes you're going to walk into situations and people aren't going to be friendly. They aren't going to be helpful. It's going to be difficult. They might see you as an easy scapegoat. And it might get hard. So you need to know who you are. And who you are is a recipient of God's grace. A recipient of God's benefit. Of God's benefiting action. The next thing Peter does is he goes on and he talks about holiness. And he says to the Christians, you need to be holy as I am holy. Okay? Now, sometimes we've misunderstood this concept of holiness. Holiness does not mean separated out from. Because then Jesus was the most unholy person around. You see, sometimes we've got this view, holiness is, oh, Lloyd, the issues in your life. Thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to go hang out with other people who don't have problems. When actually, Jesus' view is that there is a power of God at work in me that is actually contagious. That power, that healing love of God, can actually begin to rub off on him. And he can be transformed. So that some scholars talk about Jesus' contagious holiness. See, they don't view, Jesus didn't view sin as contagious. Ooh, I don't want to catch what Kate's got. No, no, no. It's, hey, I've got the Spirit of God living inside of me. She could catch what I've got. More likely the other way around. She's the Holy One. Okay. So Peter says to these Christians, you need to be holy. So what does holiness mean? Holiness means a distinctive lifestyle. If you're to be holy as God is holy, you need to be different like God is different. You need to reflect His character. You need to reflect His care for people. You need to reflect His concerns for people. It's not about being separated or removed from. It's about being different from. Jesus could engage with the most broken, sinful people, and that's all good because he believed that God was working in and through him. Greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. You don't need to be afraid of the world. You don't need to be afraid that they're going to contaminate you. You need to know who you are and whose you are. Peter wants to kind of emphasize this, so and so chapter 2, verse 9, he just kind of launches in, hey Christians, I want you to understand that you are a chosen race. I want you to understand that you are a royal priesthood. I want you to understand that you are a holy nation. I want you to understand that you are God's own people in order that you may announce the mighty acts. Or the virtuous acts of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. Peter is continually reaffirming the identity of these Christians. You need to know who you are. You need to know whose you are. You are a chosen race. Chosen. That's beautiful. It's an honor to be on God's team. It's an honor for him to fill us with his power and presence and for us to be at this intersection engaging with the world. You are a royal priesthood. The function of a priest is to be a mediator between God and others. You're a royal priesthood. You're a priest every time you're engaging with others. You are a mediator. Sometimes your mediation will have to be careful negotiation with hostiles. Sometimes it will just be picking up the broken pieces. Sometimes it will just be a shoulder to cry on. Don't confuse the different strategies we have with the mission. The mission is to mediate God's grace. That's what a priest does. He mediates God's grace, God's forgiveness. You are God's own possession. If you don't understand who you are, dealing with the world's pain can become overwhelming. You might begin to think that you're the hope of the world. Now, in a sense, you are, because you're a carrier of His hope. But this doesn't fall squarely on your shoulders. You're not alone. You can't help the whole world. You are one human being amongst many. But you have a pretty big God. And He is able to do abundantly above, beyond anything you could even imagine. You are God's people. And your role is to declare, to proclaim the mighty acts, the virtuous acts in the Greek, of the one who called you out of darkness and into His marvelous light. Okay? Now the next thing Peter goes on to say is in 2:11, he calls them the beloved. Agapeto. I think that this is becoming my favorite word. Beloved. It means you who are loved. Because sometimes I think chaplaincy can be as easy as reminding people that they are loved. Right? And a meaningful activity is to love. You want to flourish, then you have to love. That's why I think God is the most flourishing being ever. Because all He does is love. All He does is act on behalf of others. All He does is help. All He does is want to benefit. And it seems things go horribly wrong when we go, "No thanks, I can do this myself." And we as a community, we as people who are representatives of God, you as chaplains are there to remind people that they are loved. You are there to love people. Which is why I read out all that stuff about love shaping our identity and love being this massively influential and important thing. That without it, we die. When we found out we were going to have Ava, I went on a little reading spree. I'm a geek who reads books, so that's just what I do. I went on this reading spree, and I was very interested in why there was this move for the skin-on-skin contact between mothers. And now in the UK, they've extended it so that if there's no skin-on-skin contact with the mother, it must be with the father or a sibling as well. And I was like, why? It's because this baby needs to know that it's loved. And without it, there are massive implications. So much so that without the appropriate physical contact, a baby could even die. I mean, that's... So Peter gives us this reminder. You need to know who you are. The next thing he does is in chapter 3, verse 9 to 12, he gives you a little snippet on how you are to engage with others. He says, "Do not repay evil for evil or abuse for abuse, but on the contrary, repay with a blessing. It is for this that you were called." Now, what Peter's doing is he's connecting you back to Genesis 12, 1 to 3 with Abraham, which says, "Hey, Abraham, I call you, and you're going to be blessed to be a blessing, and that's going to multiply, and through you all the nations of the earth will be blessed." So Peter says this, our task, our mission, our strategy is not to engage in abuse for abuse or vengeance or revenge, because that's the way of the world. Our job is to actually respond to evil with a blessing. Because only love transforms and destroys hate. I'm in the process of a 250-page book written by two psychologists, and it's all about hate. And they keep coming back to this point that you can actually change people if you love them, but you have to break the cycle of hate that they're in. Love people. And so when Peter says that you are to repay with a blessing, what he means is a tangible benefit. Now, what's a tangible benefit? If you see me on the side of the road and I have the hood open, please stop, because I have no idea what I'm doing. Me and mechanical engines do not go together. When I was 9 years old, I could rebuild a motocross engine in 3 hours, but that's because my dad was standing behind me and helping me, and that's what we used to do together. But nowadays, I haven't touched an engine in 2 decades. I don't know anything about car engines. And so if you see me and you stop, then you are providing a tangible benefit, because hopefully you know what you're doing. Because I certainly don't. Peter says, for those who desire life and to see good days, let them keep their tongues from evil and their lips from speaking deceit. Let them turn away from evil, or I could translate that as what is harmful, and do good, or I can translate that as what is beneficial. Let them seek peace, shalom, and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. So Peter's strategy is this: hey, if you want to win over outsiders, if you want to deal with the animosity, if you want to engage well with those who are indifferent, you need to bless them. You need to love on them. You need to benefit them. You need to be what they need in that situation. Now, we could explore the practical strategies of that a little bit later, but this is Peter's strategy. We need to not engage as the world would engage, and hey, you hurt me, I'm going to hurt you, or hey, you said something bad about me, I'm going to say something bad about you, or hey, you don't want my help, so I'm just going to leave you to it. It's no, we're committed to blessing them. We're committed to helping them. We're committed to doing good, to benefit them in some tangible way. In fact, if you go back to 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 12, he says, conduct yourselves beautifully among the Gentiles. Or I could translate that as honorably. I just like the word beautiful. Conduct yourselves honorably or beautifully among the Gentiles, so that though they malign you as evildoers, they may see your beautiful works and glorify God. The way you live is important. Because people are often paying attention to what you do, not what you say. You see, talk is cheap. Supply exceeds demand. Okay, everybody talks. I do it for a living. It's easy. But to actually act, to actually be there for somebody, to actually try and help somebody, that speaks volumes. Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 17, honor everyone. I don't want to get into a long technical argument, but what Peter means here is you need to treat people as those who are created in the image of God. You need to treat them virtuously. You need to treat them right. You need to treat them in a way that is consistent with God's character and God's care and God's concern for people. Now, let's get really practical. This could be physical problems, bodily injuries, insomnia, fatigue. We could talk about all physical things, nightmares, being there for people, helping them through those things. We could talk about mental issues, people who have flashbacks or anxiety or memory loss or the struggle to make sense of what's happened after an event, the struggle to find answers. We could talk about spiritual problems, including a loss of faith or a sense of guilt or, hey God, where were you? We could talk about emotional problems of loneliness, depression, sadness, fear, a tendency to withdraw from people. We could talk about relational problems, parenting skills, divorce, family violence, chemical dependency. We could talk about financial problems. We could talk about employment-related problems, privacy problems, legal problems. Now, I'm not quite sure what your individual job description as a chaplain is, but somewhere in there is what you do. And this is exactly what Peter's talking about. Helping people in all those specific areas. Benefiting them. And sometimes it's not, hey, I can fix this, but hey, at least I can help. Or I can try and help. Or I can be there to listen. Or, hey, I've actually know somebody who can help. Or pointing them in the right direction. It's about letting your life speak. In 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7, Peter says this to these Christians: throw all your anxiety on God because He cares deeply for you. And we're back to where we started. There is a God who cares. There is a God who cares so deeply that He acts on our behalf. There is a God who cares so deeply that you are sitting here today because you have responded to His call to act. That's who you are. You are priests of human flourishing. You are priests of the living God. You are those who are called to mediate on His behalf. You are those who are called to stand in the gap and pray. You are those who are called to be a benefit and to help. So if the goal of human life is flourishing, and the right way to flourish is to be in right relationship with God, with others, with self, with one's environment, then those are four areas where you as chaplains can begin to engage with people. How's your relationships with other people? How's your relationship with yourself? What's going on in your environment? Do you know God? Have you encountered the God who cares deeply? Because as I read the contemporary situation, people are, it's all about me. We're stuck in this self-destructive cycle of, it's all about my feelings, me, myself, and I, that idolatrous trinity. And actually, it's destructive. The science says it's destructive. And so you, as a priest of human flourishing, you, as a representative of the God who cares, have to somehow break people from that cycle. Maybe it's a prompting question. Maybe it's an action. I don't know. We can talk strategies later. But as I understand it, for you to help people to flourish, you might actually have to address that or call people out on that. A meaningful life is necessary to human flourishing. Your life gains meaning. You flourish by doing these things. And sometimes I think we need to think more carefully about how your own flourishing can be a light in darkness. About how we can connect to glimmers of joy and hope in people's stories. And not just focus all the time on the bad stuff, but actually say, hey, you know, amidst all the stuff that's going wrong, one of the things I read recently was one of the best places to live during World War II was London. And I was like, wait a minute, so they're getting bombed. Like, why would that be a great place to live? And the literature suggests that one of the reasons it was a great place to live is because people had to share food. So they'd have their little gardens and they'd grow their food and they created these tight-knit communities. And in amidst all this pain and anxiety and suffering going on around him, there were these communities and people were experiencing a level of flourishing that they hadn't in a long time. It's strange that even in the midst of such pain, you can experience joy. Because remember, joy and happiness are two very different things. And if we could tap into that for people, and the way to do that is love. It may sound like a cliche, but I think we need to love the way Jesus loved. And didn't Jesus say that by this will all men know that you are my disciples, by the love that you have for one another? It seems to me that the greatest evangelistic sign to an unbelieving world is a community of people who actually care about each other. Wow. I missed that one. Peter provides a strategy. Know who you are and whose you are. He says, live a life shaped by God, his character, his concerns, his care, i.e. holiness. Seek shalom with others. Live a beautiful and beneficial life because it speaks volumes. Let your life speak. Don't feel you always have to use words, but if you can, use them. If you use words, make sure that they're the right ones. Why? Because God cares deeply. So, what I've done today is provide you with a lot of ideas that I hope and pray can benefit you as you engage with others. However, in the time that's left, I wanted to engage with you about what these ideas, about how these ideas tease out and what, if any, are the practical implications of what I've been talking about. In so doing and by so doing, I trust that you will be empowered as a priest of human flourishing, a representative of the God who cares, that you yourselves will flourish and enable and others to do so as well. So I leave you with this prayer found in 3 John 2. Beloved, I pray that you may flourish and that you may be in good health, just as it is well with your life. Amen.